Good evening, everyone. I'm Chetan Bhatt, Director of the Centre for the Study of Human Rights at LSE, and I'd like to warmly welcome you to this event on religious intolerance and its impact on democracy with our very distinguished speaker, Asma Jahangir, who I'm very honoured indeed to welcome here this evening. This event is the Stickard Amartya Sen Lecture, and it's hosted jointly by Stickard and by the International Inequalities Institute at LSE. The International Inequalities Institute is a new interdisciplinary LSE initiative, and it's the key focus for innovative research, postgraduate teaching, and public engagement regarding the question of global inequalities. The Amartya Sen Lecture has the goal of stimulating public discussion of the themes covered by Amartya Sen's work. I'm very delighted indeed to welcome Amartya Sen, who is in the audience, and who'll be coming up to say a few words after Asma's talk. This flagship annual lecture has generated considerable interest. There were queues for the queues this evening, and it focuses on a key issue affecting many regions of the world, and that's religious intolerance. Our speaker will examine the impact of religious intolerance and hatred on democracy and consider the failures of states to address intolerance and the free expression of ideas, and the consequences of that failure for women, for minority groups, and indeed for broader questions of justice and equality. In the current period, where both religious intolerance and populist far-right forms of hatred are thriving, the challenge for all of us is to protect democratic principles. Asma Jahangir is an internationally known and distinguished human rights lawyer, and she co-founded and chaired the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, which is an organization, it's a remarkable organization. It's done remarkable work in meticulously documenting, publicizing, and challenging human rights abuses in the country. She also played a key role in the important lawyers' movement in Pakistan from 2007. And after receiving her LLB from Punjab University in 1978, she was called to the Lahore High Court and then the Supreme Court in 1982. As a democracy activist, she was imprisoned in 1983 by the Zia-ul-Haq military dictatorship. She was put under house arrest again in November 2007 after the imposition of martial law in Pakistan. She was the first woman to serve as president of the Supreme Court Bar Association of Pakistan. She was a UN special rapporteur on the freedom of religion and belief from 2004 to 2010. And she served on numerous other UN panels. She's received numerous international awards and honours in recognition of her human rights work, and she's been involved in various capacities in major international organisations, including the South Asia Forum for Human Rights, the International Federation of Human Rights, and the International Crisis Group. Her writings include The Hudud Ordinance and Children of a Lesser God. Our discussant, Amartya Sen, is Thomas W. Lamont University Professor and Professor of Economics and Philosophy at Harvard University. He's the recipient of the 1998 Nobel Prize in Economics and an LSE Honorary Fellow. And it's very generous of him to be here this evening and be able to say a few words later on. Asma Jahangir will speak for about 45 minutes, and after this, Professor Sen will hopefully say a few words about the issues raised in the talk, and then there'll be time for your questions. This event is being video recorded, and we hope to have the recording of the lecture, technology permitting, and the Q&A session online in a few days. And it's also being live tweeted, and we encourage you to comment on the event using Twitter, and the suggested hashtag for the event is LSE Jahangir. But can I please ask you to turn your phones and other electronic devices to silent? The event has to finish just before 8 p.m. May I ask you to extend your warm welcome to Asma Jahangir?
Thank you very much for inviting me here, and thank you for being here. I was overwhelmed when I saw so many of you outside. I wonder whether it was curiosity, whether it was the lecture, or whether it is the topic itself. And I think it is the topic. Because when we talk about religious intolerance and how it's impacted democracy, nobody better than you would know it. For us, democracy and religion never went hand in hand. We had experienced this in Pakistan. We had experienced it in many other parts of the world where democracy was fragile, where there was a transition. But today we see that mature, established democracies are also falling apart and democratic values are being eroded because religious intolerance is being opposed through religious intolerance. And one of the reasons that we decided to have this topic was because, first of all, for me at least, Amartya, Professor Amartya Sen, is not an Indian, he's not a Hindu, he's a global intellectual. And he has insistently written about how intolerance, how suppression of freedom can lead to poverty. He has made the connection between different freedoms. He has made the connection of how people can attain their aspirations, not only through amassing wealth, but by being able to live a dignified life. And therefore, I felt that this was a very apt topic for me to talk about, as it was a lecture in his name. He also wrote about how intolerance, in one of his speeches, I'm sorry I left my three papers behind, the first three pages, but so I can't quote him verbatim. But he said in one of his speeches in India that we always had intolerance in India, but it is a question of tolerating intolerance. And that is, I think, the basic central point of my talk today. Intolerance, we all know, is infectious, and we are all worried about it today. We wonder why and how we have come to this point. I wonder that why we didn't worry that we wouldn't get to this point. Because if you really look at the big picture, you find out and you discover that Amartya was so right. When we first discovered, we all knew that Muslim women in Saudi Arabia could not even drive a car. We did not speak up, as the Saudi wealth overpowered our conscience. And when we lost global conscience, when we lost global leadership, and when we lost values that were universal, we had to come to this stage where when we felt that it was the Afghans that were suffering and were being oppressed, we said we don't want to help them anymore, as we had lit the inferno and then got the loot, and therefore we had no interest left behind for the suffering Afghans and the women and the minorities under the Taliban. We forgot that intolerance is a phenomenon that goes beyond borders. It was only after September 11 that the world woke up to the extreme tyranny being spread in the name of religion. And the lessons that we learned were simplistic, some misdirected, and others even dangerous, that widened the scope of intolerant expression. For example, lesson one was, let's have a regime change. So let's get rid of the Taliban, and let's put in warlords, and let's build democracy in Afghanistan. Now, I thought that that was a very simplistic way of dealing with a whole nation post-war, post-conflict, and actually being disrespectful to their society by believing that that society did not have any aspirations within them. I very well recall that I was in Afghanistan soon after the war, and the UN was there to build so-called democracy, to build society there, having completely forgotten that the Afghans did have a culture, and the Afghans did have a language, and the Afghans did have a heart, and the Afghans did feel pain. And I asked one of the people who was at the head of the UN at that time, and I asked him, where are the political parties in Afghanistan? He said, we don't want political parties. It will be the NGOs that will build democracy in Afghanistan. So this is the manner in which we try to build societies. The second lesson that we learned was that paint all Muslims with one stroke of the brush. All Muslims are tyrannical, all Muslims are terrorists, all Muslims are extremists. And the third lesson that we learned was that we respond brutality with intolerance and an equal measure of it. We did not learn the right lessons. We never went to the root of the problem. We did not realize that we never play with fire. Once you start politicizing religion and you play with fire, you get burnt as well. We did not learn that you do not support autocrats, whether they are theocratic or secular. And we saw that the so-called international community did support a number of autocrats that were theocratic, a number of autocrats that were secular, and who were oppressing those who took religion as part of politics. What happened was that the secular autocrats shut down all expression, all association, and all assembly. But what they could not shut down was the mosques. So they became the center of politics. And when change came, theocratic forces were more organized than those that did not believe in extremism. And you see, for example, Egypt is a prime example of it. What happened in Egypt shows you how we can sit back and tolerate oppression if it is done in the name of weeding away extreme religious lobbies. And we fail to understand that while every society has germs of intolerance, every society also has germs where people aspire for greater freedoms. Democracy cannot be transplanted in an awkward manner. It has to be supported, nurtured, not ordered around. And it grows, yes, with the help of others, yes, with the help of people within the society, but it cannot be transplanted and brought with preconceived notions. And the other lesson that we didn't learn was that Muslim world is not homogeneous. For example, women in Saudi Arabia cannot ride cars. Women in Iran cannot ride scooters. Women in Iran cannot be judges. Women in Pakistan can be judges. Women in Pakistan cannot give evidence on financial matters, but women in Bangladesh can. So there is no homogeneity in the Muslim world either. And there are different sects, there are different thinkings, there are intellectuals, and there are people who are atheists who don't believe in any religion, who may be born Muslims. But what we saw at the end of September 11th was the beginning of what we are seeing now, was the beginning of what has happened and what has culminated today. What has happened today is that religion and fear has been politicized to the extent that it plays from electoral politics into policies, into institutional discrimination. Guantanamo Bay was only the first of its kind. It was just a symbol which showed you the decline of a democratic belief and decline of those leadership and that leadership that professed to lead a free world. The responses were that if an Iranian government forced women to wear the scarf, we will force women and girls going to school not to wear the scarf. And if you look at, for example, the double standards that were always there became more visible. And these double standards that became visible became a tool into the hands of those extremists who said that there is nobody for freedom, that those who profess that there are freedoms in this world only want freedom for themselves and not freedoms from another for others. And there are several examples that they can give us, as we all know, from the Patriot Act to the stop and search in this country, to migration and the manner in which some of the migrants are treated in the West. So the argument was that there is no such thing as liberal secular ideas, which I believe is wrong. And what we have done is we've simply played into their hands. I give you one example that has hurt me always, and I give that example here today because Aung San Suu Kyi is a person that I admire a lot, and I think we owe her a lot as well. And she is also a co-laureate, like Amartya Sen. But her unwillingness to protect the Rohingya Muslims shows to you how intolerance has seeped into politics. And the level in which it has seeped, it immobilizes politicians. It immobilizes even those politicians that have will, that have a goodwill towards the freedoms that you and I aspire for. If you look at the whole question of how it took a long time for the UN to even address the question of Israeli settlements in Palestine, which was such an obvious violation of the self-determination of the Palestinian people. The obvious reason for destroying a two-nation or a two-state theory. But it took a long while. And if you look, for example, the secular India, and I must say that I have been a great admirer of India's secular politics and India's deep and I call it now aging democracy rather than an old democracy. And I remember in 1985, I was in India on a Law Asia conference, and I had to read a paper on discrimination against women in Pakistan in the criminal justice system. And there was a minister by the name of Margaret Alva, who was chairing that session. And she was horrified after I finished my paper and said, "My God, this can never happen in India." And I said, "Madam, what is happening in Pakistan is so infectious. It can happen anywhere." And if I see her now, I will be able to give her several examples of how Indians and Indian politics has changed. And the reason for this is also large-scale impunity for those who commit crime and offenses in the name of religion. Whether it is political leadership or whether it is the leader of a terrorist group or whether it is individuals who have committed crime in the name of religion, they are called back on the table like the Taliban are to this day. And everybody is willing to have a dialogue with them. But a man who has stolen 50,000 rupees from a house is never called back to the table and forgiven. And this is impunity has to be addressed at all levels, not only at national levels, but also at international levels. Then we saw that there has been polarization. This kind of double standards, this kind of hatred versus hatred has polarized society to a point that in the past we saw that in the movement, the Taliban movement or the jihadi movement before that, or the Al-Qaeda movement, women were not participants of terrorist groups. But now we are seeing that even women are becoming participants in groups that want to foist their values on us through the barrel of a gun. And who is challenging them in a more effective way? I think there is a void in our society. I do not see any policy, global or otherwise, leadership that is challenging the narrative, that is challenging them in terms of reaching out to the people, in terms of education to the young people, looking at the root causes, because wherever I go to a conference, I am told poverty is the root cause of all this. Well, if poverty was the root cause of all this, then the millions of poor people in this country would not let us be alive today. When we are talking about poverty, they exploit poverty. And what we are talking about is, if poverty is the root cause of it, then eradicate poverty. Let's fight with poverty. Let's not fight with the poor who have been exploited. And I say this to you because I have done several cases in Pakistan where young people have been exploited to the extent that they did not even know where they were going. They were picked up, they were taken, they were armed, and they were forced into accepting money for their families that were dying of hunger, or virtual hunger. And they came into a life of their own without even realizing that they had gone so deep into crime. And I wonder who is to blame for this. And there is no common action in the world. If young girls are picked up in Nigeria by Boko Haram, they're not Nigerian children. They're my child, they're your child. And we don't see that common action at all. We also see that religion is being manipulated as a tool, and it has become a tool in the hands of unscrupulous politicians, where they will use religion to get to power, either against religious intolerance, or by pretending that they are not religiously intolerant, but that they are simply protecting their own religion. We have examples of people who have used to get into power. It's like a ladder that they go up, that ladder of democracy. And once they reach the top, they just throw away the ladder. And then they've come into their own and use religion for persecution purposes. There are others who have used it as an instrument of fear. And we see that spaces for free expressions have shrunk even in mature democracies. Free expression in the sense that there can be no discourse on religion. And every time you have a discussion on religion, you're told that it's racism. Well, there is a difference between racism and religion. You cannot change your race, but you can change your religion. And religion is a set of ideas which needs to be discussed. And you cannot asphyxiate debate on religion. Whereas you don't discuss race because it happens to be there. You cannot change it. That's your expression. And so this kind of a thoughtlessness has left a vacuum in the political development not just my country or your country, but in the world. We have seen, for example, many examples where religious intolerance not only affects democracy, but also affects economic growth. If you look at the example of Nigeria, there are certain states in Nigeria that apply religious laws, and there are others that don't apply religious laws. And if you visit Nigeria, you go to these states which are called the Sharia state, you see a decline even in economic wealth. And there is oppression, while in the non-Sharia state, wealth or economic well-being is better. You see, for example, in India, some states have anti-conversion laws, others don't. And the ones that do have anti-conversion laws, there is more political, religious conflict in those very states. We see in Pakistan, for example, in 1986, we had the blasphemy law. Before 1986, we had two cases of blasphemy, and now we have thousands of cases of blasphemy. Now, that just goes to show that the law itself, when it comes to religion, you have to be very careful on legislating, because the law itself can become an instrument of persecution. And so I think that if you look at many other examples of how the leadership of the so-called free world has in a way betrayed us by challenging religious intolerance in ways that are undemocratic and are not compatible with human rights. In my own country, disappearances started after September 11th. There may have been a few disappearances earlier, but it was not a pattern. And what had happened was that the US wanted religious extremists to be handed to them, so people were picked up and they were given to the CIA to be taken away to Guantanamo Bay or to be taken away to Afghanistan. Well, our intelligence agencies felt that if the leader of the free world wants us to disappear people, why can't we help ourselves? So once they had done it for their masters, they decided to disappear people from Balochistan. And this is how disappearances to this day occur in Pakistan. And if you look, for example, at the whole question and the whole debate about not only disappearances, and I am not certainly saying, let me first make that absolutely clear, I am not putting the blame on the free world. I am putting the blame on myself. I am putting the blame on those societies which let religious intolerance breed, and prosper in their societies. But equally, I am saying that those that did not believe in religious intolerance did not act with wisdom, did not act with care, did not act with a consistent policy when they were challenged as well. And that is why we have a polarized world today, a world where freedom of expression, but in particular, freedom of association and freedom of assembly has become very difficult, not only in countries like myself, but also in mature democracies, as I said earlier. India is one example. The US is another example. In my own country, of course, we cannot meet. Many of the non-governmental NGOs have been stopped from working because they criticize what is called CPAC, which is an economic corridor that China is helping us to build. CPAC has become a kind of a national anthem in Pakistan. You can't speak against CPAC. If you do so, then you can be arrested, you can be harassed. But ours is an old story. Now, what about the new stories that are emerging in the world? And the new dynamics that is erupting is the dynamics that we are faced with not just religious intolerance, but we are faced with a world which has become insecure and uncertain. The alliances that are taking place, even in the name of development, do not respect what we call political freedoms. And we have time and again sort of preached that political freedoms do not come before economic freedom. Economic rights, I believe, go hand in hand with political rights. And one of the reasons I always argue for it is that as far as political rights are concerned, you can ask governments, please don't torture. It doesn't cost them anything not to torture. Please don't arrest people arbitrarily. It doesn't cost them anything to do that. It's a frame of mind. But if you ask the governments to have development in education, in health, they may have an answer for you, which I don't buy, but they may have an answer for you, that they don't have enough resources. But resources is not an issue when you're asking people to respect the dignity of its fellow citizens and people who live within their jurisdictions or people who travel within their jurisdictions. Now, if you look at not only Pakistan, but I read, for example, what has happened in Europe, a report that throwing a poke head or a grenade on mosques, assaulting Muslim women with headscarves, demonstrating against superstores, selling halal are happening on a daily basis in the 21st century Europe. But this, by all means, does not mean that you absolve those who recruit children in the name of religion, kill, and participate in conflicts. If you look, for example, My own country, I used to say, it's one of the worst as far as human rights records are concerned, and particularly religious rights. Not anymore. I say it's not one of the worst, but it's amongst many who are now the worst. We have also to face up to new challenges. The new challenges that disturb us are the ownership that religious intolerance, forces of religious intolerance are taking over. The ownership in digitalization, social media, and that is where the opportunities that liberal politics have, they are not being captured enough. So we have information, a lot of information, a lot of disinformation, attacks and threats, but we have not built on the opportunities for building greater partnerships across the globe to resist the turnaround of values, to protect the universality of basic values. That are the only sustainable ingredients of a democratic system. And as Professor Amartya Sen rightly said, we have to understand the remarkable empirical connection that links freedom of different kinds with one another. Political freedom in the form of free speech and elections help to promote economic security. Social opportunities in the form of education and health facilitate economic participation. Economic facilities in the form of opportunities for participation in trade and production can help to generate personal abundance as well as public resources for social facilities. Freedom of different kinds can strengthen one another. It helps the creators and creativity is built, and thus technological advance and information on science can be on our side if we look at the whole phenomena of all the rights together rather than each one separately. But at the end, I would like to add that you can preach religious tolerance. At the end of it, there are two necessary ingredients. First is a public opinion that you will have to build, and a public opinion that does not say that there are double standards, but a public opinion that says, I will not tolerate intolerance. And secondly, we have to rethink the way our democracies work, because democracies must be a platform, a springboard for people with ideas, with people who have certain aspirations, people who feel, who have a common conscience with its electorate to really take on the leadership. But it has now become a springboard for opportunists. It has become a springboard for those who want to even make themselves rich. It has become a springboard for leadership that just wishes to have some kind of control over people in the name of democracy. And unless and until we don't challenge not only democratic values that are being undermined, but also the kind of leadership that the new or the old democratic system is producing, we will be failing, and we will be failing not even in our endeavor, but we will be living in a world that will be more and more oppressive. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed for a very powerful and enlightening talk. I'd like to invite Amartya Sen to give his thoughts on the talk, if he's ready. If you'd like to come up here and join us, please.
I shouldn't really be here. I mean, they all come to listen to Asma and Sigele totally brilliant talk, as always. And I'm really thrilled that she agreed to come to our favorite institution, the London School of Economics, and give this talk. I've been an enormous admirer of Padma Jahangir for many years, many decades, in fact. And I think it's, of course, not only totally endorsed the importance of the ideas that she presented, but also the, I must express my admiration for the clarity with which he presented and force with which he presented these ideas. I think it's quite extraordinary how she has fought for freedom from intolerance of all kinds, including religious intolerance, through different channels. She is, of course, an outstanding lawyer and defended many very difficult cases and prevented an adverse judgment being carried to the courts when there have been a kind of public excitement about trying to penalize some actions which had neither support from the human rights perspective nor even in many cases from the Constitution and now safeguards limited as they are in the particular country, in this case, for example, Pakistan. In addition to being such a brilliant lawyer, she has been a visionary thinker in being able to see with clarity how human rights are threatened from many different directions and what we can do about it. And the last particularly, she has been totally extraordinary. If you think what the Pakistan Human Rights Commission, which has been really led by her and by our friend Rahman, how much it has achieved. It's in some ways, as an Indian, and there are many Indians here, I can say that, we have a much easier situation. The Human Rights Commission has a legal recognition, as it has in South Africa. It does not have a corresponding position in Pakistan. In fact, you may describe it simply as an NGO. And it's still, because of clarity of vision, because of courage, Asma has been threatened with grave physical harm and threat and threat even of obliteration. With the courage, with the vision, and with the conviction she has, and the others involved among her colleagues in the Pakistan Human Rights Commission and in the whole movement, they have achieved, even without legal support, as it were, without the support in the way that the South African or the Indian Human Rights Commission is supported, still achieved extraordinary things in protecting vulnerable people, in getting certain perspectives heard. And I think there's a lesson, if I may try to mention in that, that throwing up in one's arms and saying, look, we can't do anything because the situation is very unfavorable, that comes up so often in every field of deprivation, whether we are dealing with poverty and economic deprivation, we are dealing with social inequality, traditional inequities, as well as new ostracizations. In many of these cases, it may be thought that, look, what can we do? This is the state of play. I think what Asma and her colleagues have shown is that even when it looks as if nothing can be done, a lot can be done. And there's a real lesson in that. I just to give an example, when some years ago a young woman was in the Fort Valley, was caned. Was it caned or whipped? I'm not sure. Yeah. Caned and for violating Taliban dress code or some other behavior pattern. The Pakistan society was upset about that, but it wasn't vivid in people's mind. Pakistan, despite having a kind of authoritarian religious positioning, particularly from the period of President Zia, it has the general public opinion has been hostile to iniquities of this kind. But it had to be brought out. I think I'm right in thinking that until Musharraf changed the laws, no religious exclusionary party got more than 12% of the votes in the elections. And until the rules were changed about, you know, madrasa trained people could stand in the elections and others couldn't unless they had a BA degree or some such thing. But what happened is that at a great risk of life, and I remember seeing Asma shortly thereafter, I read about it and I asked her what happened. And it was some very courageous person in the human rights movement who went to see the caning and made what looked like a long telephone call, which actually consisted of taking a long video of the event. Now, this is taking a real risk. If he had been caught, his life would have been certainly in danger. But then, happily, he wasn't caught, and the strategy, which required vision, and the point that she ended with, one of the 2 points, namely, to awake the public opinion, to make it more active, make it more participant. That's what the strategy is, but it required courage, it required truly daunting willingness to take risk. But then when this guy came back and put it on the Pakistan television, and people could see this young girl being caned, the revolt was so extraordinarily large that the army, which wasn't intervening earlier, simply had to intervene because the opinion was strong. It's not that it converted the Pakistan people. I think the Pakistan people did not like this kind of persecution anyway. But there's always the thought that, what can we do? But the fact is that it's so atrocious, and the vividness of what was going on brought out the need to act, and then people insisted the army had to do something, and indeed the army did, and cleared, at least temporarily at that time, that area. I think in all these, there is a kind of mixture of vision and courage and initiative from which we have to learn in every area, whether we are dealing with human rights of a freedom from religious persecution, or whether we are dealing with inequalities and poverty in economic terms, or whether we're dealing with social handicaps and so on. So I think the big lesson that I'm always very eager to listen to Asma, and I was, of course, delighted I had this opportunity, thanks to this lecture, to bone up on what's going on. But one of the big lessons I've learned from my friendship with Asma over many years is why it's wrong to take any situation to be hopeless. Even in the direst of situations, like the Taliban ruled Fort Valley in the frontier of Pakistan, you can do something. And I think for that vision, for that understanding, and for the eloquence with which, and the effectiveness with which Arma Jahangir had pursued a kind of cause which so many of us share, but we don't get around to doing enough about it. I think for that, my admiration, of course, is boundless to Arma. So I'm really very grateful that she came here to give this talk, and of course, delighted that my favorite institution, LSE. I used to teach here for a long time, and my association with LSE goes back even earlier when I was a student in Cambridge, which can be quite a dull place. I used to escape. I think the university, I mean, I'm not blaming Cambridge in particular, university towns have a kind of dullness. In the more than a decade that I taught in Oxford, I lived in London. I'm so delighted that this is happening in LSE, and so glad that you are initiating it. And many thanks indeed from Arma. So I would like you to join me in expressing our appreciation of Arma Jahangir.
And can I also thank Amartya for being so generous and coming here this evening to speak to us. Very much wise words of hope that are very much needed today. Thank you. Okay, we have time for questions, and I know there are many people here, and it shows the level of interest in this particular area and in Asma's work. I want to take questions in groups of three, and you'll see our wonderful stewards coming around roving with a roving microphone, and they will come to the people who've raised their hands that I've indicated. So please wait until they're with you and hold the microphone right in front of your face so everybody can hear the question. And I know this can be cause a little bit of a delay, but please be patient. Also, when you ask your question, can I request you state your name and where you're from? And can I please request no long statements or speeches, please? Just nice, crisp, perfectly formed questions would be ideal. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Who would like to go first? There's a question at the front, just here.
Hello, thank you for your talk. My name is Moiz, I'm from India. My question is, given the reaction to the Mumtaz Qadri execution and, of course, honor-based violence in Pakistan, is there political will to fight religious orthodoxy to change public opinion in Pakistan, and how can it be encouraged?
Thank you. And there's a question from a person just in the middle there. And also here from the front. Can we take the question from the front first, please?
Mirvais Wakil from Austria. I want to go back to the issue of the Taliban. So you mentioned that basically after 2001, the West, along with the Afghan government and Pakistan government, actually physically attacked the Taliban institutions. But I'm not necessarily sure whether we tolerate the religious extremism that they believe to be normal. How would you approach that problem if you don't want to do it by force? Then how would you approach changing their minds or views, when it comes to religion?
Okay, thank you very much. And a question in the middle.
My name is Rashi and I'm from India. You spoke about building greater partnerships globally. I just wanted to understand if you could elucidate on how students can build these partnerships, especially, say, right now, you know, in South Africa, there's Feast Must Fall, JNU in New Delhi is under siege, so is HCU. So how can these partnerships be formed, if you could sort of elucidate, and thank you.
Okay, I'm just going to take one more question from the back. Thank you.
Hi, good evening. My name is Lavish. I'm a law student from India. So my question is that in democracies like India and Pakistan, where the constitution and the state clearly empowers one religion or the other over the other, for example, the state sponsoring one religion or having provisions in the Pakistani constitution which says that only a Muslim can become the president, or the citizenship bill in India which provides easy citizenship to Hindus from Pakistan and Bangladesh, can the religious minority communities actually feel safe, or can ideally the religions be even feel equal in such circumstances? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. That's a very good bunch of questions. Asma?
Yes, it hasn't been easy. I mean, first, the talk has not been easy because I have a 3-year-old granddaughter who took my first 3 pages away. So
it was still a brilliant
talk. I was left with 3 pages less from my talk, and the beginning of the talk is always important.
Editing is always good.
But in any case, you're talking about Mumtaz Qadri. Well, there is no political will anywhere in the world, leave alone in Pakistan. But there are pockets of will. For example, eventually, the death sentence of Mumtaz Qadri was confirmed by the Supreme Court. And I have to say this, and this I'm saying to you because I feel very strongly about it, that the lawyer who was prosecuting Mumtaz Qadri, he is under great threat. But I have never got an international NGO asking me, how is that poor lawyer? But I always get many groups, I'm very happy that they are doing it, I'm not criticizing them. When a Christian is in jail, a lot of Christian groups, and I'm happy that they do it, call up and say, can we do something? But I have never got a Muslim group call up and say that this poor lawyer, can we do something for him? So what I am saying is that what we need to do is this, because I'm a Muslim myself and I can give this call, that we should not be hiding behind the philosophy and the talk that we hear of the right-wing Muslims, that other people have double standards. They at least look after their own. We don't even look after our own. And so I think that we have to do that. Then there is the question of Taliban and religion and politics. You know, the Taliban were very well tolerated. They were there in Afghanistan for a long time. They were there that when women couldn't even go out to have a glass of water. So it's not that they were punished for oppressing the Afghan people. They were punished, don't forget, for hosting Osama bin Laden. So the lives and the oppression of Afghan people was not as sacred as the lives of others. I believe that September 11th was a very tragic event, but I believe what the Afghan people went through was even more tragic. And then the question of constitutions, I agree with you. I mean, if you're talking about our constitution and yours, one of the things that I've never been able to understand, it says about freedom of expression, that you cannot criticize friendly countries. That's one of the restrictions in your constitution and ours. And I've always wondered what is friendly country in Pakistan. You know, is it China and Saudi Arabia? And then when I said that at a conference, somebody said, no, they are not friendly countries. Chinese and Saudi Arabians are Pakistani citizens. So is the US a friendly country or isn't it a friendly country? So, I mean, you know, these kind of things are there. And I do believe, in my own country, I feel that religious minorities have had a very rough time. So have they in your country. I went there as a UN rapporteur on freedom of religion. I was astonished. I went to Orissa, I went to the south, I went to Rajasthan, I went to Kashmir. I was quite astonished. But and as far as our country is concerned, people are beginning to address the question of religious minorities now. 10 years ago, there was a self-denial. First, there are hardly any religious minorities. Then our religious minorities live very well. We have no discriminatory legislation against them. We have plenty of discriminatory legislation against them. And the fact that religious minorities are shrinking in our country and leaving the country by itself is a great indication that we treat them shabbily, we persecute them, and then we expect them not even to complain when they are attacked. That was the best. I heard a minister say very recently about an attack on the Ahmadis that they shouldn't have said it at least. So it's like I'm always reminded when I started practice in the early days about a woman who was in court, and the judge said, the point is that she got slapped. That's fine because that's allowed. But she protested against it. And that is why she's not a fit mother. So, I mean, you know, these are the kind of realities that we live with, but we shouldn't live with them. We must every day remind our policymakers, our leadership, throughout the media, through the courts, through any tool that we have, that we must not discriminate, whether it is religious minorities, whether it is ethnic minorities, whether it's gays, whether it's lesbians. We cannot and we must not discriminate against people.
Thank you. We have another round of questions. Yep.
Hello. My name is Salim and I'm from Karachi. So you talked about how the Pakistani government, by negotiating with the Taliban, they sort of attempting to negotiate with the Taliban, they sort of condone the violences committed by the Taliban. So how do you think governments should traverse the tricky balance between equity and between justice and between peace in these situations? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very good question. And from, yeah.
Hi, my name is Toyosi. I come from Nigeria. My question was more because if we're talking about taking personal responsibility as a people, but we also expect some level of responsibility to come from a government. But in Nigeria, for example, when you think about issues with Boko Haram, it's mainly concentrated in the north, and it's not just government the government's inability to act. It's also the fact that power is concentrated with the northern leaders, and the northern leaders have a strong impact on how much terrorism or how far Boko Haram goes. How do you reconcile, how does a government that has made certain arrangements with leaderships in certain regions, how are they able to act and, you know, make any change that can impact the nation as a whole?
Okay, another good question. Yes?
Hi, I'm Sadath Chowdhury. I'm from London. I have a question for Asma regarding the disappearance of the recent bloggers and activists in Pakistan. Do you think the recent online smear campaign concerning the missing is a warning shot on digital freedoms in the country?
Okay, and just two rows forward, the man in the green scarf. Yeah.
Yeah, my name is Ayushman, and I'm from India. But India is an experienced nation of India is an experienced nation of democracy. So, which now has a very the rightist government based on a core ideology of Hindutva. So in the light of this thing, how do you see that the India and Pakistan the relationship with will grow in the future, in the near future?
Okay, thank you. Excellent question. Asma, would you like
to? Well, thank you very much. I think all the four questions were excellent, but before I answer them, I first must thank Amartya for being very complimentary today. and as always is, but I wish that I had done more justice to this talk that I did today. But, you know, you talk about justice and peace. What happened in Afghanistan was that people wanted peace and they wanted to do away with justice. And so impunity was given. And the result was you neither got justice nor got peace. You cannot, for the sake of peace, abandon justice, or for the sake of justice, abandon peace. So what you said was that how do you deal with the Taliban? When they have committed crimes, if I have committed a crime, I must be picked up and I must serve my sentence. They cannot be above the law. I mean, to say that, yes, we are so fierce that we are above the law, and therefore whatever we say must be listened to, is, I think, giving in to oppression. And this I say to you because many times in Pakistan I have been accused that I talk about the Baloch nationalists in a very different tone than I do about the Islamic militants. But there is a difference. The Baloch nationalists are fighting for their rights, whereas the Islamic militants are fighting to thrust their values on me through the gun. And that is the difference. And that is what we think that is what the Taliban want. If they want me and my children and my grandchildren and my great-granddaughter to wear a burqa over our dead bodies. The second is, you're absolutely right about Boko Haram. I read a lot about it because I tell you that that's the most fearful thing that I have read for many and heard and seen in many years. And religious intolerance cannot rise to the peak that it has risen unless governments did not support it. I mean, we've had religious intolerance in our part of the world since we were children. I remember as a child we were reading about Muhammad bin Qasim coming and destroying the temples and the statues of Somnath, and we were supposed to be very gleeful about it. But that did not become institutionalized till governments did not support religious intolerance, till governments did not bring into the school curricula which said that Muslims are the only people who are pious, the rest of the people are infidels and can be killed. And that is why Boko Haram got emboldened, because they could manipulate politically your political leadership there. I've been to your country and I've looked, and I really was very fearful that this would happen many years ago, how very quickly they were getting emboldened. Yes, bloggers, arrest of bloggers and disappearances of bloggers is not only a warning, but our country, on the surface, you can see that there is a transition to democracy, but the deep state is still there and very active. And I say that because it's not only the bloggers who have got disappeared now. There are many people who have got disappeared in the past. There are people who've been threatened every day. There are people who've been told not to move out of their houses. So, and politicians are scared. All institutions are mindful of the fact that we have democracy in name, but the real power lies elsewhere. But as Amartya Sen said, people are challenging it. And gradually, they will get marginalized. It's not easy to take power away. It takes many years and decades to take power away from people. It means skill. It means dedicated effort. It also means risking. And a lot of people have taken risks in our country, whether they're politicians or writers or poets or human rights activists like ourselves. And we have been put, for example, in a strange quandary also at times, when we talk about tolerance and intolerance, I remember that I was asked to do a case of a political leader who had criticized the country and the formation of the country. And nobody was willing to take it. Because the case was of this nature, that he was accused of treason. And I thought to myself, I will take it. I do not agree with his views, or may not agree with his views, but I respect the fact that he has a right to say what he wants to say. And there were a lot of questions of why I took that case. Similarly, I took the case of military trials. And many of the politicians came up to me and said, why have you taken these cases of military courts? Because we are only trying those people who are terrorists, and you yourself are threatened by terrorists. But the point is that you should apply the same standards to others as you would apply to yourself. So I asked one of these gentlemen who asked me this question, I said, would you like to be tried by a military court? And obviously the question was no. And so if I don't want to be tried by the military court, I don't want anyone tried by a military court, regardless of what they're accused of. So these are dilemmas that we, even human rightists, go through of what to do and what not to do. And therefore, I think that bloggers is a huge challenge for us because our phones are tapped. The surveillance is there. And, you know, we have something in our country called Schedule 4. I don't know if many of you know that or not. Schedule 4 means that by law, you can actually put surveillance on a person. So you can monitor that person. And this is part of a national action plan. So this national action plan for security, and that is another point that I think I wanted to raise, was that in the name of security and national interests, we are also undermining not only human rights, but democratic values. Well, if I don't have my right, I don't care where I live. I don't care. I mean, it's not the right of a place to exist, but it's the right of people to live in that place with dignity and with rights. And I think that that is something that we have to be able to bring out much more forcefully. And you said about Handwata growing. Well, welcome to the club of South Asia. It's. But I can tell you that your civil society, and by civil society I just don't mean NGOs, I mean civil society means lawyers, doctors, whatever, will have to challenge it harder. And it's not only a question of civil society, because I think also very important are your political parties. And I say this again and again, because whenever I've gone post-conflict to see a country where there have been political parties, regardless of how bad, ugly they may be, societies have still come back together rather faster than those where there are no political parties. So political parties are a very important part of civil society. And the fact that it has flourished is not because they are great communicators. It's because you don't have an opposition that has anybody to communicate. And there's no counter-narrative. Not only in India, we need a counter-narrative of liberal politics. What is the counter-narrative of liberal politics today? Who is the face of liberal politics today? Nobody. Nobody in the world. So I think that that missing spaces in politics has also given rise to adventurism, to opportunists, to get more and more into the political arena, which is in a way souring the situation so that there is no challenge, there is no planning, there is no thinking, there is no creativity that we can go forward.
Thank you, Asma. We have time for another round of questions, and I'd like to take, say, another four questions. Lady at the back.
No. To build on the Hindutva point, I wanted to ask, do you think India's, because of the political party, has reached a tipping point of where we're going more towards religious intolerance than we ever were in the 20th century? And do you think it's not going to be eradicated because of the world situation that we in that we are in, that people are that people want that politicians are saying what people want them to say, in terms of religious intolerance and in terms of politics and religion? And that's what's driving the political parties as well?
Okay, thank you very much. And if you could pass the microphone to the gentleman in front of you.
Hi, I'm Ishan from India. I just wanted to ask that Pakistan is made in the name of Islam, right? And so a country being made in the name of religion, doesn't that in itself undermine the basic tenets of democracy? I mean, isn't it a basic flaw that since it's being made in the name of religion, you would obviously favor a certain community and not other communities? So isn't that in itself a basic flaw?
Okay, thank you very much. And if you could pass the microphone to the back row. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Anam and I'm from Pakistan. You mentioned there's a lack of political will to address the issue of religious intolerance. And living in Pakistan, it also feels like there's, if not a sense of apathy, but definitely desensitization to this issue. So do you think there's hope for mobilization of civil society, maybe in the form of collective activism or grassroots movements to deal with this issue? And if there is hope, how would you predict or say that it would manifest itself?
Okay, thank you. And yes?
Yeah, thank you. My name is Alesia. I'm a Ukrainian-born Russian, and I just wanted to ask a follow-up question on your response to how to deal with Taliban, but it's a more abstract one. So what you said, that if you commit a crime, there should be a mechanism whereby you're persecuted and you answer for what you've done. So how would you achieve that and prevent, for instance, international intervention where actors will unavoidably have their own political interests? How would you do that if there is no independent judiciary nationally, and if international institutions like, I don't know, ICC, they don't have universal jurisdiction, they're just complementary to national jurisdictions? How would you solve this problem?
Okay, thank you very much. And I think the last question from this gentleman here.
Thank you so much. My name is Khaled, I'm from Syria. With the ongoing conflict in the Middle East, including what's happening lately in Myanmar, a lot of Muslims in this region would tend to believe in conspiracy theory, and mainly global conspiracy theory, and mainly probably also the Western movement against Islam, with the Islamophobia and all these movements against religion. So on the other hand, you would see that some scholars would say Islam in itself needs reform, because countries who are driven by Islam or who are Muslims are also involved in the conflict. So to which extent do you think that Islam is curable in this context? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Five questions, a large number of questions. But Asma, I'd like you to try your best.
Well, these questions can get me into a lot of trouble, I can assure you. But to return, I think I didn't answer your question quite properly in the first one. Where will India and Pakistan go? I have no doubt in my mind that India and Pakistan will eventually have to tolerate each other. And that Pakistan will soon learn that you cannot economically or otherwise grow unless you do not negotiate with your neighbors, unless you do not have a proper understanding with your neighbors. You can't be the tutor and the spoiled person of the neighborhood. I think that I'm quite convinced with that. But I do agree with you that when you make a country in the name of religion, you naturally introduce a certain level of intolerance to start with. I have no doubt in my mind on that. Because countries should not have religion. They cannot have religion. It's people who are within these countries that must have religion. And I hope, coming back to the question of one of my young colleague friends there who talked about conspiracy theories, I will then come to the other two questions later, that we have in our countries, we also have conspiracy theories. September 11th never took place. Osama bin Laden was never here. But the fact remains, I remember very well that day. I was traveling to Islamabad, and my husband was in Singapore, sitting in the airport, and he called me up and said, "Don't go to Islamabad, where are you? Do you know that this has happened?" And I went back to sleep in the back car of the car and said to the driver, "If you see some problems, turn the car around." And then next I was at my house and I said, "What happened?" He said, "Nothing." So I said, "Do you know this has happened in Pakistan? It's world news that Osama bin Laden has got arrested from here." So he said, "Then where else would he have got arrested from?" So I went to court. And I went about my work in court, and in the break, everybody's talking about the cases. I said, "Hey guys, do you know what's happened in this country? Osama bin Laden has got arrested from Abbottabad." "Yes," they said, "we've seen it on television." I said, "But you know, it's a big problem for us." He said, "What's the problem for us?" "No, but he's got arrested from our country." So one chap got up and said, "Where did they think he was going to be? In Paris?" So my point is that these conspiracy theories are everywhere. And they hide behind these conspiracy theories. I'll be very clear with you. I believe that there has always been Islamophobia, my friend, even before September 11th. I can assure you of that. Being a Muslim woman who wears shalwar kameez mostly, I have traveled to the West, and people have asked me that, "Oh, are they cutting hands in your country or not?" And I said, "The law is there, unfortunately, but so far nobody's hands have been cut. Because if they really began to cut hands, then the level of corruption that is in my country, there would be people without hands." So in any event, you know, there is a certain amount of Islamophobia, and there are some reasons for it. The way we arrogate to ourselves that this is the only religion in the world, that we are the only pure people in the world. And why must we thrust our values on other people? I have gone to Canada where I have been met by groups of Muslims saying, "We want Sharia law here." I said, "Well, very well. Why don't you go to Saudi Arabia? Why don't you go to Pakistan? Why don't you go to Bangladesh? I mean, why do you want these poor people to get scared every day?" You know? So, I mean, I think that we have to respect that. Nobody will accept the fact that a man can have four wives and walk in front of these four burqa-clad women and say that this is my right to do. Sorry, it's unacceptable. Whether it's religion, whether it's divine sanction, whatever, it's not acceptable. Nobody today in the world, you and me included being Muslims, I cannot say, and I will never say, and I hope that nobody will, that my daughter is in any way inferior to my son, or that I should discriminate against her by giving her half that of to my son. No, I cannot. I cannot justify it. So we must rethink our own values. All religions of the world, you have to take them with a pinch of salt. You know? Be laid back about it, you know. When people ask me, "What are you?" I am a laid back Muslim. So I think there is something beyond religion, is human values that you cannot deny. You cannot deny the fact that even if you humiliate a child, no matter what color, what religion that child, what sex that child belongs to, that child will never forget it. And humiliation, no one will forget. No. Torture is the same for everyone. I mean, so let's be clear about history. I mean, I've heard people tell me, "Oh, there was no such thing as Holocaust." Oh, for God's sake. You know, please, people are learning lessons. Let us learn our lessons as well. This is what I would say to you're like my children who are young people who are Muslims. Don't get carried away by this. "Oh, there's Islamophobia." There is Islamophobia. Always has been. There's Christianophobia also. I mean, see how the Jews have suffered all their lives. But we should not therefore become like those people who ostracize others. And then I had this question about desensitization and how do we mobilize? It's a good question. It's a very good question. But I want to say to you, I just want to relate to you. It came to me just when you were talking about it. There was a woman in Multan, in a place called Nawabpur. If you go to internet, you will see that incident. And she was stripped naked and made to parade in the village. And we read that news, and this was during Ziaul-Haq's period. So I called up X, Y, Z, made 300 phone calls as usual. Come, hell has broken loose. Come to the Mall Road. Let's go for a protest. And five women turned up. But I insisted that we must protest. So we picked up five women, five posters, and we ran around looking like fools. And we were completely embarrassed. But next day, one of the authors, who was a very well-known columnist, wrote, it's not that five women came out, it's that why only five came out? And the next week, we had a larger protest, and the people got arrested. So what I am saying is, do not despair. Do not ever despair. I will tell you that when I started my work, a lot of people said, oh, these are promiscuous women. They want women to have sex. Yes, because we were against a law that punished women who were raped and could not prove that they were raped. And all sex outside of marriage was punishable with so many lashes. So that is what we were painted as, nude women who want to have sex. Then came honor killing. Then in the Senate, I was called a woman who was corrupting the mind of the youth. If you will recall those days, maybe you were little at that time. But the same party that said so has now voted for a law that punishes honor killing. So things do happen. So I don't think that you should feel shy of. You must continue, and learn one lesson from a mullah. He goes five times a day to the pulpit, and five times means at some time you do listen, even to him. So to you, I'm sure more people will listen. And then the last question was about the question of independent judiciary, and I agree with you. There can be no democracy without an independent judiciary. And you cannot have religious tolerance unless you have unbiased judges. And that is perhaps one of the most difficult things to manage. And as far as the ICC is concerned, there's a big question mark of how effective it is. But what I am fearing now is an isolation of Europe. That Europe is being isolated by other countries and quite big powers. And therefore, European values, which very much match yours and my values, will be undermined. So I think that when we are looking at small picture, we should also look at the big picture. And we should not let Europe be isolated. And a bloc be isolated, a huge bloc that wanted to, that at least said that they want freedoms. And that they were driven by not all their electorate, but a large part of their electorate, for freedoms, because I cannot deny the fact that there have been more protests here against oppression of your own societies and of your own governments than anywhere else in the world. So I think that we have to acknowledge that as well.
Okay, I think we've run out of time. Can I thank Asma Jahangir for her wonderfully, wonderfully inspiring...
Sorry, your answer?
Okay, we are running out of time, and maybe you can speak to Asma later. So can I formally thank Asma Jahangir for her wonderfully inspiring lecture this evening? It's been absolutely wonderful.